That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95bfm.com/bcasts.
It's the climate change.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Lachlan Balfour toku ingoa. Nō mai, haere mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to the Monday Wire for Rahina. Monday, oh, bye Deb.
Bye Deb.
The 9th. Are we on the 9th of September?
We are the 9th of September, 9-9.
Wow.
2019.
Yeah, 9-9-19.
Yes,
I'm joined by Sherry, producer. Hi. Away last week, here this week. How are you going, Sherry?
I'm good. Yeah. I'm good. It's the Monday Dream Team, so.
It certainly
very
is.
Happy to be
just
here.
Me and Sherry today. Jemima is unfortunately away, and we miss her terribly, but the show has not suffered, I feel. So, coming up.
Full thing coming up.
I speak first with Chief Ombudsman Peter Boshier about his report into the conditions at Naafa Prison. Southern Cross is back to give us all the updates on what's going on in the Pacific, and there's a lot going on. The Green Party co-leader James Shaw joins us to discuss the blue economy, mental health funding, and what it's like being a small party in government. And finally, Sherry speaks with the Opportunities Party leader Jeff Simmons about the relaunch of TOP and how they're going to shake the legacy of Gareth Morgan. I reckon it'll be a hard one to shake. You just can't forget the mustache, can you?
Just in the cats.
And the cats. There's a lot going on. But I look forward to that interview. It should be interesting. Hia ha ofakaro. If you have any thoughts to share throughout the show, we would love to hear from you. Tuku pātui mai. Send through a text to 5395. Or why am I? You can call the studio to chat with one of us on 309-3879. I'm sure you will. You love it when we talk about prisons.
Yeah,
they do. And
they
we love talking to you sometimes. Most of the time.
Ring in. We love it.
And if you get a bit belligerent, I will put Sherry on. She's much better at dealing with that than I am. Shall we get into it, Sherry?
Let's get in.
Well, hey.
Dive in.
Kei te whakarongo koe ki te wire, marunga irirangi pō.
The Wire.
Naafa Prison is a former maximum security prison that now houses many prisoners who are on remand awaiting trial. They recently had a surprise inspection from the Office of the Ombudsman, which found a number of faults with how the prison is being run, including issues with prisoner privacy and lack of rehabilitative programs. I spoke with Chief Ombudsman Peter Boshier about the report, first asking him what the main findings were.
Well, at the high level, the great shame about this unannounced visit was that this prison was always going to be the showcase for the relationship between Māori and corrections. It was going to be the way in which we would address the high rate of Māori imprisonment. So Naafa is really in the seat of Māoridom in the far north, and yet the missed opportunities were obvious for all to see. So there were physical things we found. But I think at the high level, the great shame of it was that this golden opportunity of forging a meaningful relationship for change had been missed, and this was operating. It's meant to operate as a low security prison. In fact, it operates at a high security prison regime. So really, just looking after people, that's all, and not at times doing that up to the standard instead of that crucial further point of rehabilitating.
And what were the physical conditions of the prisons like? What was it like for prisoners there? What was it like?
This is an unannounced visit, which means that the housekeeper doesn't get the chance to do the washing before the visit comes. We just arrive, and that's part of our right under the Crimes of Torture Act, which sets up our jurisdiction. So our inspectors arrive, and they have a routine that they go through. The striking thing that we found, there were three things. One was that the staff chose to lock the prisoners out of their cells for quite long periods of time, which meant that they could use the exercise yard. So far, so good, but then they couldn't get access to toilets. The toilets are in their cells. So the first thing was that there was a stench in the yard as a result of that being used as the makeshift toilet. The second is that this is a warm part of the country, Naafa, and there wasn't adequate access to water, which is a direct breach of an article of the convention. The third thing is that temperatures rise to a pretty heady level. And particularly in the kitchen, the temperatures were reaching an unacceptable level with inadequate ventilation. So the answer to your question is, in a relatively new prison, we were pretty disappointed in the conditions we found. Well, the other thing just to mention is that double bunking permeates throughout this prison. This is a prison built for 350 that operates with a we used to call them a muster, call them now a group, of about 650. Wow. So double bunking is pretty rife. Now, that sounds okay, but, you know, you've got a cellmate. But you've got to do everything with the cellmate in the room. Eat, do your toileting. I mean, you know, it reduces people, doesn't it, to a level of dignity which is unacceptable.
Is this a problem with how that individual prison has been run, or, because you spoke about double bunking, and that's kind of a government mandated thing that we need to have double bunking because of how many prisoners we have. So is it a need for more government oversight, or just that things need to change at that prison?
You're right that double bunking is the result of a number of prisoners being sentenced without the facilities being ready to take them. That's happened as a result of the passing of legislation and sentencing guidelines. So that's been a consequence. I think as far as, this is a really important question you've asked, how is it that you achieve cultural change? I don't think you can look and expect the government to do all of that. I think that a government certainly has a responsibility at a crimes of torture level to make sure that minimum standards are right. But it seems to me that leadership starts at the top, and it seems to me that each prison will want to have a management which is enlightened and which really buys into the ethos of head office, which is to be more tikanga based and more culturally conscious and looking for outcomes rather than just babysitting hard prisoners.
And you have spoken about this prison in particular, Nafa, sort of when it opened, heralding itself as a prison that will work on having tikanga values, treating prisoners in a different way. Why, and this, I suppose, in your review, found this just isn't being done. What are the implications of this?
Well, I think that New Zealand, as it matures, understands that the Treaty of Waitangi is more than a document in which non-Māori should have regard to. It actually means that we recognise each other, our values, our culture, our dignity, where we each have come from. And in terms of Māori, we're in this prison, the population, prison-wise, is 47% Māori. You'd want, wouldn't you, to be operating in a way which enables prisoners to rediscover important parts of their tikanga, their culture. One wants them to leave with something they can hang on to, and it may be that they came in with nothing to hang on to or cling to. So it seems to me the answer to your question is that our leadership's got to change attitudinally, it seems to me, to bring about the best culture for rehabilitation and recognition of dignity.
What happens now? So you've done this review, you found that things were not adequate. What's next?
So there's always some shining of the light that occurs when we do a visit and a report. And the reason for that is that the Act, Crimes of Torture Act, requires us to table our reports in Parliament. We do that. That always attracts a fair amount of attention, mm-hmm. and in this case, a fair amount of media attention. And that's a very good thing, can I say. And the reason is that most New Zealanders know that we've got prisons, and they know something about some of them. Everyone's heard of Pāremaremo and so on. But this does shine a light for New Zealanders who want to have a look at what happens inside a prison, to see a little bit without having to actually go there. We do photographs and we do descriptors, so it's good from that point of view. Now, coming to your question, we often do follow-up visits. We ask, first of all, whether the corrections will accept our recommendations, and in this case, they accepted all but three. And
What did they not accept?
So, the answer to your question, the three recommendations not accepted were privacy of prisoners in what's called ISU, which is it's a close security unit. Our concern has been that when prisoners are naked or partially naked, they shouldn't be able to be filmed and should have a degree of privacy. Corrections still finds that difficult to accommodate. Then a slightly lesser one, perhaps of moment, is that again, prisoners in what we call ISU, when they attend their review, should be provided with copies of their management plans. And it may not seem huge, but look...
Well, it seems a reasonable request, though.
It does, and I'm not sure what the difficulty over that really was. Those two recommendations were partially accepted and partially rejected. The one that, surprisingly, they rejected, prisoners have unrestricted access to toilets at all times, they rejected. They must feel that it's too difficult to manage, or in a prison regime it needs to be more staged in terms of when there is toilet time and when there isn't. So those were the recommendations that weren't accepted in totality.
And if they don't accept them, is there anything you can do, or is that just, well, we've done our part, there's nothing we can then do to make them accept this?
Well, we keep on and on about it, and look, often when we make a recommendation, I'll give you an example. About 2 years ago, we released a seminal report called A Question of Restraint, and it was to do with prisoners in some prisons, such as Auckland, who were being restrained in tie-down beds for lengthy periods of time. And the response of corrections at the time was, but they will harm themselves. It's in their own interests that we are able to take care of them and allow them not to harm themselves in often pretty awful ways. So it was suggested that as ideal as it was, corrections had no choice but to do this very restrictive, quite inhumane way of restraining. And we kept on and on about it and said, look, there are other times when you can manage high-risk prisoners with regimes and proper staffing. You should be able to do it. And lo and behold, it was announced to me some months ago that they have abolished the use of tie-down beds, and they are now able to manage such prisoners differently. So I'm ever the optimist, and I think at times when we don't achieve rapid progress, we know that some things can be done quickly and others take more time.
I'm just, this thing about the bathroom and not really having access to it when they're out in the yard, is this something that, because they are treating the prisoners like they're in a high security environment, is this why they do it? Would you not see this kind of thing happening in a lower security prison?
I think you interpret the position correctly. What we were told was that there is a danger of prisoners going into other prisoners' cells and violence occurring. And by the way, that the rate of violence in prisons is unacceptably high, and in relation to this prison, violence remains an issue. For instance, 46% of prisoners said that they felt unsafe at some point while in prison. 29% of prisoners said they'd been assaulted while in the facility. 9% said they'd been sexually assaulted while in the prison. So violence is an issue, and we all know that. We see that from everything from television to what have you. So in order to minimise the opportunity for prisoners roughing each other up, they locked them out of their cells and had them in the exercise yard, where I imagine they were more visible. That's the reason why they weren't in their cells and locked out. It was to control prisoners going into each other's cells and the possibility of violence occurring. That's why they ended up in the situation that we found them.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
Yes, that was Chief Ombudsman Peter Boshier talking about his report into Nafa Prison. We've got a quick break and then Southern Cross. Woohoo.
Iconic high street boutique Storm is moving to a new location, and they're having a relocation sale to celebrate.
From now to September 15th, Storm's high street store will be packed with samples, seconds, end of line and end of season stock, all at discount prices.
Don't miss this chance to land unique designer garments at a sale price. Don't wait, get in while stocks last. for Storm Relocation Sale, 23 High Street, on now to September 15th.
In the market for a cleaner, healthier home? Craft Homes is your first choice. They work with you from design to project completion for a home that's minimum impact, maximum efficiency. Building Homestar 6 homes through to Passive House standard, Craft Homes are smarter, more energy efficient, and built from sustainable and environmentally friendly products. Don't just build a home, build a more sustainable future. Craft Homes. Homestar approved practitioners. Go to crafthomes.co.nz.
Are you a dick?
Nah.
Do you like yummy food?
Oh, yeah.
Well, then what's for dinner tonight?
Well, I was thinking...
Wrong. What you need is a Lucky Taco Fiesta Kit. Everything you need to make Lucky Tacos at home in just 10 minutes. Tasty, spicy, fresh, Lucky Tacos make you feel good. And with free delivery in Auckland, why not make it a ritual? Pick up a Lucky Taco Fiesta Kit at your local Faro Fresh or get free delivery direct from the HQ at theluckytaco.co.nz.
Interested in 3D modelling, web design, programming, animation or robotics? Then the Mind Labs Tech Toolbox evening courses are just what you're looking for. 5 courses to choose from. No experience necessary. Book now at motat.org.nz.
Well, my name is Chris, and I'm here to say, looking for a flatmate in the Lynn that's grey. You gotta be cool, and you gotta be tough. You gotta be a vegan, and no pets or smokers.
Room in Freeman's Bay Cottage. Me, urban sophisticated wine expert, French cinema aficionado. You, educated, tidy, silent.
Room in flat, Mount Eden. Text Dave.
Whoever or wherever you're after, the 95BFM Accommodation Guide is here for you. Email your listing to accommodationguide@95bfm.com. The 95BFM Accommodation Guide, every Thursday on drive and online at 95bfm.com.
Now it's time for the Southern Cross.
Certainly is that time. Southern Cross is back with its great... I really like that intro a lot. And with me in the studio is Pacific Media Watch contributing editor Michael Andrew. Michael, how are you going?
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You might be wonderful. Things in West Papua are not so good.
No.
What's going on there?
No, I'm definitely separated from the developments there. But it's still very much the West Papua show. Do you want the good news first or the bad news?
Let's lead in with the good news.
Okay. So, well, the good news is the internet has been restored in Papua. And as we know, it had been shut down by the Indonesian government to prevent the unrest, the protests to racism and for independence to spread. So it was effectively quelled to stop the trouble from spreading over the region. But it did, regardless. In any case, the internet has been shut down, but it may be just a temporary measure. If the unrest continues to spread, it will be shut down again. So it's been restored for the meantime, but that's the good news.
Are we seeing more news coming out now? Is it really... going off?
Well, still the same degree of actual news, but definitely a lot more Facebook posts, which are hard to verify. But I think you'll slowly see the actual media starting to report more from the location and from the actual region itself. But yeah, lots of Facebook posts, which are quite concerning. They just take time to develop. To obviously verify them, you can't just go ahead and say, oh, this stuff's happening right now because this person posted this. But
is there a high level of censorship with the internet, even though it's back on?
Okay. I think so. The Pacific, especially West Papua and Papua New Guinea, they use Facebook a lot for their communications. I mean, I think it's hard to censor everything. This blackout was definitely a case of heavy-handed censorship.
And what's the bad news?
The bad news, okay.
Do I want to ask?
Last week I spoke on the show, there were reports of half a dozen people killed in the Daya Regency, which is a remote part of Papua. That was unverified, but then some Australian outlets started posting video of soldiers firing upon unarmed civilians outside a government building. It's hard to tell exactly what's happening from the video, but you see soldiers pointing their guns at West Papuans with their hands on their heads and firing and into this building. You don't see anyone killed per se, but it's certainly harrowing, and there's all the screaming going on, and the fact that these reputable Australian outlets like CBS News and The Guardian have published the video, it's, I don't know, you kind of got to take it seriously. That was probably one of the most heinous reported incidents that happened last week. But also, a bunch of people have been arrested for raising flags, raising the Morning Star, which we've talked about as a punishable crime. It's punishable if it's raised higher than the Indonesian flag or if it's raised solo.
Right.
If it's raised alongside or directly below the Indonesian flag, it's kind of okay. But then it's a bit of a cowboy zone, so it's probably safe not to do it at all. But yeah, so these folks that got arrested were actually Indonesians. And this is why these protests are different from anything that's happened in the past, because it involves a very ardent, passionate body of Indonesian activists who are backing the West Papuan cause for independence. And that's what separates it, and that's why it's getting so much media play, not New Zealand, but elsewhere.
Because they're Indonesian, they might be less likely to actually prosecute them for raising the Morning Star than if it were a West Papuan?
I doubt it. There are reports that they're in prison right now in Jakarta, and they're being forced to listen to nationalist songs over and over again as a form of psychological, psychological torment, I suppose, which is not very nice. But yeah, probably the fact that they're Indonesians is going to make them look like traitors more so than insurgents, as they term West Papuans, for practicing any kind of independence action. News is the reports of people getting killed and attacked have not been investigated. No one's been held accountable. And human rights groups are saying, well, these need to be investigated. These need to be looked into. They can't just be swept under the rug. They're unverified at the moment, but we've got all this information on Facebook and these Australian outlets saying that six people were shot dead. So it needs to be investigated. There needs to be some kind of due diligence.
Well, that segues quite nicely into our next topic. Human rights measures are to be deployed in the Pacific. Tell us about this.
Yes, indeed. So a new human rights measurement initiative is being rolled out in the coming months. And the organisers, which is called the Human Rights Measurement Initiative, have held a series of workshops in New Zealand. Now, this has been good because there hasn't been any meaningful human rights measurement in the Pacific other than Fiji, New Zealand and Australia. And New Zealand and Australia naturally scored quite high, you know, in the 70% on multiple categories, which is kind of economics, freedom of expression, freedom to question the government, all this kind of stuff, freedom of assembly and association. There's quite a long list, freedom from torture. New Zealand and Australia scored quite high, and Fiji scored very low, 30% on a lot of these things. But the organizer, Anne-Marie Brooke, has said that she's concerned, or she's not expecting all the Pacific countries and governments to embrace the findings, because it's going to make a lot of people look quite bad. Unfortunately, that's just the nature of how things are in the Pacific at the moment.
Has Australia or New Zealand responded?
Well, the New Zealand government is actually partially funding this initiative, which is a little bit tricky because that wants to maintain its independence.
Yeah, but hard when one of the better countries, I guess, or the better scoring countries.
Yeah, so New Zealand has put in 600,000, which isn't, you know, that much, but it's going to help. But a clause had to be inserted into the contract with New Zealand's foreign ministry to safeguard the initiative's independence. But yeah, that is at least going a little bit of the way to start addressing human rights issues in the Pacific, to have those metrics in place so that governments can make meaningful changes based on actual data and see where the problems are in their society. But it's a question of, are these governments, who probably many of them are the cause of the low human rights issues, whether they're going to embrace the findings.
And something we've not talked about for a while, the University of South Pacific. Do you want to remind us what happened there and what's happened since?
Yeah, okay. So it was about 6 months ago, or earlier this year anyway, the vice chancellor he raised these allegations that finances and contracts and administration type stuff within the organization had been mismanaged and abused. People were being paid a lot more than they should. Contracts weren't being filled out, and it was all a bit loose and fast. So the University of South Pacific Council said they would investigate it. They hired an Auckland-based firm to look into it, which has been investigating the issue for the last few months, and they've released a report last week that says they've found a lot of stuff, a lot going on, and they are going to be moving on that in the next week or so and advising the council on the best way to act. It hasn't actually released the details of what they've found, but it is it correlates with the initial allegations.
So I guess it might be a bit too early to know, but do you think we could see some quite serious repercussions from this?
I don't know if there'll be serious repercussions, because the allegations took place under the former chancellor, so he's already left by now, but it's definitely going to result in some serious changes in management structure and in how they do things at the university, which might affect how the academic and education departments progress as well. And as you know, the University of South Pacific is a close partner of Pacific Media Centre. We share a lot of content, and they're pretty much the leading, outside of New Zealand, the leading journalism hub, grooming young journalists for Pacific journalism. Mm. So that's very, very important to a lot of people from Papua New Guinea, a lot of people from Solomons go to Fiji to get their education, and then they return home. Mm. So anything to do with the university at the management level, it needs to be looked into to ensure it doesn't jeopardize the integrity of the education and journalism department.
Well, I look forward to hearing more about that one. Just finally, the Fijian Prime Minister may or may not have assaulted someone. What's going on?
Yeah, okay, so video emerged 2 weeks ago. The opposition MP, Pio Tiko Duadua, he alleged in Parliament that Viruk Bainimarama, the Prime Minister, had assaulted him, which the Prime Minister denied. And then a couple of weeks later, some video surfaced, this was last week, and it basically showed the PM, Bainimarama, walking up to the opposition MP and grabbing him and giving him a bit of a tussle. Looked pretty aggressive. It wasn't like a serious assault, but it was definitely... was something. So an investigation ensued. The police looked into it. But on last week, the report that was submitted to Parliament basically said that no, nothing was found, despite the video evidence. Prime Minister basically had to apologise for verbally assaulting the MP, but there was no mention of physical assault. And it also said that the opposition MP should apologise to Frank Bainimarama for personally targeting him, or launching a personal attack. And so there was a mass walkout on Friday night of the opposition MPs, and the fellow in question, Tika Duadua, has been suspended for 6 months without pay for walking out. So that's a really... it's crazy.
6 months without...
It's pretty unfair. There's no justice, really.
Do you think this is the last we're going to hear of this?
Probably not, but I think that's just the power that Bainimarama wields. He's a great leader on certain issues, but he is very much an ex-military man, and he does wield a lot of power, and he can be quite the intimidator. And I think the rhythm and the beat of Parliament kind of that moves to his drum, really. As far as we can tell, it's a pretty unfair result, but that's how it is. But yeah, I'm sure it won't be the last you hear about it. This guy's he's walked out and he said, I'd rather lose my seat than lose my dignity, but he's got a backing, so I'm sure it'll be ongoing.
We will see. Thank you so much, Michael.
Thank you.
You can read all the Pacific Media updates, Pacific Media Centre updates at pmc.aut.ac.nz and asiapacificreport.nz.
That was the Southern Cross.
Kia ora. You've reached 0800 Jacinda. Unfortunately, John Tamahere is out just now. So is Jacinda. I think they might be out to lunch. I'm here though. I'm Jeff Simmons, the leader of TOP. We're going to be relaunching the party brand on October 3. We got this number because we found that, as usual, our current group of politicians aren't very good at following through. If you're calling because you'd like a homeless person moved along, I'm sorry, but TOP knows the only way to do that is by fundamentally fixing the tax and housing systems. Then we can get homeless people, young people, all sorts of people into their own home.
Righto, Sherry, what was
all
that?
Right, well, that was the Opportunities Party leader Jeff Simmons on 0800 Jacinda, which you can all ring if you want to have a listen. I spoke to Jeff on what's happening next with TOP's relaunch, Gareth Morgan's influence, and what an evidence-based policy structure looks like.
Before we get into that, what do you reckon about that stunt? I reckon, it's a bit cringe, I think.
You know what, I reserve my judgment. It's a little bit clever. I think it's a little bit clever, but I don't know.
Well, anyway, it's better policy than John's, I'm sure. Here is the interview.
Yeah, basically, we're now a membership-run party. I'm the leader, and we are about to relaunch for the election in 2020.
Because in 2018, the board applied to deregister the party. Why have you now changed your mind?
So that was when Gareth Morgan was still in charge, and he made that public, and our membership sort of rose up and said that they didn't want TOP to disappear. So Gareth effectively handed the party over to the members, and since then, it's the members elected me as leader, and the members have been funding the party, and it's a completely different operation, really.
Why is it a different operation?
Oh, well, because under Gareth, he was the leader and funder, and it was really his baby. And now, it's like I said, it's a membership-led operation. We have a much larger board now. We have members have a much greater say in how the party runs, and ultimately, we're all in it together.
Right. So is it fair of me to say there's a conscious movement to try and remove the link with Gareth Morgan?
Yeah, I mean, Gareth had. Obviously, we're grateful to Gareth for setting up the party. He helped get the momentum going and helped create the policy, which, is largely still intact. We have the same sort of, evidence-based future thinking ideas in place. We are going to tweak the policy a bit. Our members made it pretty clear that, they didn't enjoy all aspects of Gareth's style, of how he delivered things. So, our aim now is to be more cheeky and less arsy.
I hope you don't mind me asking this, but obviously Gareth has made some comments about the TOP party, and it seems like even beyond this, he's still so intrinsically linked to the party. Is it possible to separate him?
Oh, I think so. I mean, I think people will see that when we rebrand on the 3rd of October, that it will give us a clear link. And like I said, I mean, obviously we are grateful for the input that Gareth gave. But now this is now a movement, This is now owned by the members. So it is going to be a completely different beast.
Gareth Morgan invested a lot of his own money into this party. So moving on forward, is it still financially viable without his personal investment?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, we've been fully funded by members since Gareth handed the party over. So that's more than a year now. We are, gearing up, tooling up for election in 2020, and we're still, talking to a variety of funders out there. But the fact of the current situation in New Zealand is, the current political situation is that if we can get back to where we were in 2017, around about 2.5%, that would put us on a level pegging or even in front of New Zealand First. So it would make us the fourth biggest party in the country. And with that, going into election year, that would give us serious clout and momentum. So that's really our target over the next few months to to get back to where we were in 2017. And if we are successful in that, then the sort of bargaining power and funding will naturally follow in terms of our 2020 election campaign.
What does a member-run party look like? What does that make it different from the other parties?
Well, the thing that probably makes us most different from other parties is actually our policy committee, which is run by policy experts, and our members decide what they want our policies to achieve, but we make sure that our policies are designed by experts to make sure that they will actually, you know, deliver. That this is the big problem with politics in New Zealand is that, you know, political parties design their policy by basically by surveying the public and working out what the public wants, and often the public don't actually know what's going to be effective to achieve what they really want. That's the crucial part of our policy, crucial difference from other parties. We don't intend to be as democratic as something like the Green Party are. And if you hedge, you know, too far in that direction, you can't really get anything done. We're balancing member input with expertise, having experts in the right places.
Tell me a little bit about 0800 Jacinda, because you're saying how you'll follow through with these policies. How do you plan on doing that?
Well, I mean, obviously housing is a... So John Tamahere set up 0800 Jacinda so that people could call it to move along homeless people, which is really just criminalising homeless people. It makes the problem even worse. I mean, really the problem we have with homelessness is deep-rooted in our society in terms of our relationship with housing. You know, we as a country are using housing as a get-rich-quick scheme, and it's absolutely nuts. It shouldn't be a get-rich-quick scheme. It should be about, you know, providing homes for people. We're definitely the only party that is committed to fixing the housing situation in this country.
Because with 2.4% last election, why do you think this time round you'll move over to the 5%?
We knew at the last election that actually if everyone who wanted to vote top had voted top, we would have ended up with about 8%. The biggest barrier for us was this idea of the wasted vote, as if voting for red and blue, the same old National Labour coalition, is anything, is really an effective vote in the first place. Our focus is going to be on eliminating that narrative. We are going to... Well, you know, if we're going into election year where we finished in 2017, obviously that'll give us a lot more momentum, give us a realistic shot at 5%, and it'll also allow us to have conversations with National Labour about contesting some electorate seats as well, targeting some electorates. How we've seen how this government operates, I think people have realised a couple of things, that really National and Labour are not that different after all. You know, everyone in 2017 was voting for change, and now we realise that we've just got a new colour scheme without any real fundamental change. And the second thing I think people realise is the power of that central ground that Winston commands. If you're in the place of the Greens are at, in out, you know, stuck on the edges of a major political party, you don't really have any bargaining power, and you're a complete waste of time. The place that has bargaining power is in the middle, where Winston is. We need a party that's in that middle point, arguing for housing, for the environment, for these future issues that are coming down the pipeline. That's the place where we can seize the power and actually force these career politicians to actually do something. That's our focus, very much.
With all this talk about change, why is Top the party that is going to bring this change? Why is Top running again?
The key strategy here is to be in the middle. You know, that's how we can get real change. Older generations, generally speaking, are going to vote for the status quo because that's what's got them to where they are today.
Top has called itself a radical centrist party.
Yeah, that's the phrase that I use when people try to, you know, put us on the left-right political spectrum. You know, we want to achieve the goals that, you know, what's centrist New Zealanders say they want to achieve. The difference with us is that we're actually going to do it. You know, like I said before, a lot of politicians create their policy based on what sounds good, what surveys well. I mean, and we've seen that with Kiwi Build. I mean, that was never going to work. We said it before the election. We actually need to force these politicians to do things that will actually work, and that's where that expert input, listening to experts, really makes a difference.
You keep talking about expert evidence, right, and having policies made up of experts. Could you expand a little bit on that? What is that?
Obviously, like I said, a lot of politicians come up with their policies based on what surveys well, what sounds good to the public. In our view, the appropriate place for public input is in deciding what are we trying to achieve, what do we want our policies to achieve. But once we know that, that's when you go to the experts. I mean, it depends on the policy. We have on our policy committee right now, we have an environmental expert, we have an innovation expert, and we have an economist, that's myself. There's an awful lot of expertise out there that politicians ignore. They come up with ideas that they think can't be sold to the public, either because they're too complicated or because...
Am I fair in saying that, I guess, TOP wants the public to vote on their end goal, but wants the experts to have the final say in terms of the process of getting to that final goal?
Yeah, I mean, if you design a policy by committee, you end up with crap policy that doesn't achieve anything. And when you look back over the last 30 years of New Zealand, that it's pretty clear to see why we haven't really solved the problems that we are facing. It's because we've been designing policy by public opinion rather than by what actually works. So yeah, you've hit the nail on the
head. My only concern is, looking from the other side, would the public feel nervous or tense that they have no say in terms of the means of getting to that end?
What we are suggesting actually is, in terms of if you really want to talk about fundamental change in the way we govern the country, we want to see much greater use of citizen assemblies and these sorts of deliberative democracy methods as a way of making decisions, and particularly at a local level. So devolve decisions to communities and provide them with the expertise in order to make their own decisions, because, like I said, politicians don't tend to listen to experts because the ideas are too complicated to sell, and because often they will these ideas will be upsetting those that are currently in power, those that currently have money. So what deliberative democracy or citizens' assemblies do is that they say, right, well, let's allow this community to make its own decision about how it wants to deal with this sort of stuff, this particular issue. But we will give them the best expertise in order to help them make that decision. We are very much in favour of greater decision making by people, but it has to be informed. Just having referendum for everything like this government are doing is a complete cop-out, because so many people, as we see with this cannabis debate, so many people don't bother to actually inform themselves. They just vote it based on what they feel. And that's why we end up with this family first scare campaign. And who wins the cannabis debate will just depend on how much money they've got to spend. That's not an effective way to run a democracy.
Do you think the general public will engage with these experts? Because some might say that the experts you provide might be biased or aligned with party policies. Would they be non-partisan, or how would that look like?
There is an established methodology for how you come up for how you devolve, create these citizens' assemblies. The crucial element to them is that you have to provide more than two perspectives, because if you just provide two perspectives, then people will fall into this usual partisan sniping that we see in society. Red versus blue, or right versus left, or unions versus businesses, that sort of stuff. In designing a citizens' assembly, the crucial thing is to have more than two perspectives. If you can have three to five perspectives, then people start to see the nuance in a debate and can start to take a variety of positions. And you actually just get a lot more thoughtful discussion and debate on the way through.
Their relationships with their girlfriends or their wife. They shouldn't have more than one wife at a time.
What? What the hell?
Yeah, it's turned into a bit of a complicated install.
You've tipped out my undies drawer.
Yep.
My kimchi's gone everywhere.
Yeah.
There's a dog in the sink.
Ha!
That's heat pumps, mate.
Don't leave it up to some cowboy. First Stop AC and Electrical are your first stop for heat pumps. The full range of models, top quality installations from an experienced team of installers. For a warmer, healthier home, First Stop AC and Electrical. Go to firststop.co.nz or call 0800 178 7867. That's 0800 178 7867.
What an occasion. My friends, the music, the atmosphere. You know what I could go for? An interesting cocktail.
Liquor King Delivery, everything you need for an interesting cocktail delivered to your door.
Hot dog!
Discover interesting cocktails and more at Liquor King. More than your average bottle store, Liquor King has that little something extra. And now there's free delivery on any order with code BFM. That's free delivery with code BFM. Liquor King. Go to lk.co.nz. Terms and conditions apply.
Hemp is hitting the mainstream with Burger Fuel's new electric Pooha. Innovative, sustainable, nutritious, limited edition, and out now. A nutrient-rich lineup of crumbed hemp and brock bites, puha and cabbage kraut, hemp oil aioli combined with fresh rocket, an ounce of relish and avocado, all sitting in a wholesome organic hemp sourdough bun. 100% locally sourced and 100% vegan, given to Hemptation. The electric puha, available now at Burger Fuel.
I should be a DJ. It's just choosing songs, and I'm so good at choosing.
Whoa!
You've got what it takes to select an excellent tune? Ready to make the call? Listen in to 95BFM Breakfast every weekday. Text in your pick for final call, breakfast's final track of the day, and be in to win a Yui Boom every week, thanks to our mates at Orcon. Plus, all the choicest tunes live on in the 95BFM Final Call Spotify playlist. Many make the call, few are chosen.
Wednesdays, one to forward bridge. Tune in for your fair share of great open-minded tracks. A wide range of supportive and encouraging music with Bridge. Kick back and chill with the Wednesday one to four with Bridge. Your vibes aren't ever the same.
Ko te wire, tēnā marunga BFM, you're tuned into The Wire on 95BFM. It is, of course, Tūiki o te reo Māori, or Māori Language Week. I got a good little phrase here from Lillian, the news director. Ke te heke mai te ua anō. And that means it's raining again, which is a good one for Auckland as of late. Isn't that right, Sherry?
It's really good that it's sunny. Is that what we're talking about, the weather?
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, okay. Anyway, here's James Shaw.
It's time to hear from the Green Party with co-leader James Shaw.
It certainly is that time. I was up bright and early to talk to James. We discussed the blue economy, mental health service funding, and what it's like being in government. I began by asking James about his meeting with Kirk Humphrey, the Minister of Maritime Affairs and the Blue Economy in Barbados.
We talked a lot about the threat that small island states like Barbados are facing from the changing climate. Obviously, they are exposed to increasingly frequent and severe hurricanes in the Caribbean, and obviously the timing was kind of apt with the hurricane hitting Bermuda at roughly the same time. But also, you know, what's his government doing about it? What's our government doing about it? Are there areas of cooperation that make sense? And there actually are.
And what exactly is the blue economy?
Yeah, so what they've done, and there are a few governments around the world that have done this, is they've sort of taken a view of ocean and marine conservation and of their, you know, fishing industry, and they've actually combined those and said, well, actually, if we view these through the lens of sustainable development, then actually having a minister of oceans and fisheries, where the job isn't just to exploit the ocean, it's to actually manage human activity in the ocean really carefully so that it can be sustained for multiple generations, is a sort of a holistic view of that. And so that's really his role. He's the first minister of blue economy for his country. It was something that they brought in when he started in government a year ago.
Would you like to see something like this in New Zealand?
Well, I mean, to be honest with you, I haven't thought it through thoroughly what the implications would be. There is some time, I mean, often what we do here is we have those roles separated in order to create a tension between them. So, for example, you have, you know, Minister for Conservation, which includes marine conservation on one side, and the Minister for the Environment. And then on the other, you've got the Minister of Fisheries. And that actually, having them, having those roles separated means that they can each advocate for those different positions, if you like, and then, you know, Cabinet can kind of work through to, you know, ideally a happy medium. You know, you'd have to sort of work out, you know, what the consequences might be of pulling them in together. But it's certainly an interesting idea, and when you consider that New Zealand has an economic zone, you know, roughly the size of Europe, it's not inconsiderable.
Moving on, the government has announced $6 million in funding for mental health services. Can you talk about this a bit and sort of how you feel the government's kind of commitment to tackling the mental health problem in this country is going?
Well, you know, I was frankly surprised. I fought four election campaigns for the Green Party in New Zealand. And the last one, it really struck me how important mental health was as we were getting around the country. It wasn't something that we had planned to campaign on particularly, but it really was just this huge kind of outpouring of people saying we have got to address the mental health crisis in New Zealand. So it became one of the big hot ticket items of the election. We responded in this year's budget. We put $1.9 billion over the next 4 years into mental health services. And the announcement that David Clark and Jacinda Ardern made yesterday is the first kind of tranche of that, if you like, about 3 months after the budget, saying, you know, here's $6 million for mental health services, which will help about 170,000-odd people around the country.
And as you said, it was the hot ticket item around the last election, and the Greens promised to introduce counselling, free counselling for under 25s.
Yeah.
How's this progressing?
Yeah, good. So we've set up a pilot in Porirua, a program called Piki, which is essentially youth, well, it's exactly what we said in the election campaign, you know, free counselling for people under the age of 25, largely delivered through community services. And the budget, that $1.9 billion that I was talking about, includes funding to expand that out around the rest of the country. So it's kind of getting cranking. Obviously, we'd like to be moving faster than we are, but, you know, it's all there.
So do you think this is something we could see fully rolled out by the next election?
Well, there'll certainly be a lot more by the next election. I don't actually know if we're going to be able to get around the whole country at that full provision, but we're certainly working on it as fast as we can.
Excellent. And you have been in government for a while now, 2 years. How's it going?
2 years.
is it what you expected?
Well, you know, I still haven't worked out a very good answer to that question, because I don't think anything can prepare you for it. So whilst you can observe it and get a sense of what it might be like, the actual experience of it is quite different. And as I used to say, you know, there's a difference between knowing you're going to get hit by a truck and the experience of being hit by a truck, right? So it's, I guess it is, in many ways more than I expected. And in other ways, you know, there's always those kind of disappointments of things that you thought you might be able to do and are really struggling to get over the line.
Speaking about that, you have made a few pretty big compromises so far that haven't gone down so well with the membership. Do you think you'd have to compromise as much as you have been?
Yeah. So, I mean, this is the nature of proportional representation governments with coalitions, right, is that not every party gets what it wants. In fact, no one gets everything that it wants all of the time. And so you have to kind of set ground on some things, otherwise you're not going to get anything done at all. The thing that I sort of hadn't really anticipated about this government is because it requires all three parties in the coalition to agree on something, it does actually mean that you've got an enforced consensus and you have to back each other, otherwise, you know, you literally wouldn't get anything done. And so we've actually only been able to do the things that we've been able to do because of the other parties, you know, support. And I think people often sort of see it the other way around, that, you know, they just see what we've kind of been held back on. And yeah, there is compromise. But actually the things that we put to the Parliament and to the public are things that actually a majority of New Zealanders agree on, as evidenced by the coalition.
And there's an election coming up next year. Quite often smaller parties and sort of government get punished for the sins of the bigger party, I guess. Are you worried that you might be punished at the ballot box for some of the things this government's done wrong?
Well, look, one thing that I'm really proud of is that the Greens are the one party that has defied the history of support parties in government, and that our polling has been basically rock solid since the election. It hasn't budged. It'd be nice if it went up. but at least
that was James Shaw for the Green Party. The Wire.
Sorry to cut off James slightly early there, but I don't want to run into Penny's show. Thank you to everyone who spoke to us on the Monday Wire today. It's been great.
It's been good
thank
fun.
You, Sherry. Thanks for everyone tuned in. Up next is The Wonderful with Penny.
That was The Wire. A 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.